You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Thursday, Rapide Thursday. I'm your host, Jess, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producers Joe and Amelia. Joe, would you like to tell us what you've got coming up for us in the show?
Yes, so today I spoke to Dr. David Welch about New Zealand's border reopening being shifted to April. I talked to Linda Stewart, the former president of the NZEI and the current principal of Mayroad School, about the most recent OECD report. And I also spoke to the Dental Association about calls for an improvement to New Zealand's dental care prior to World Oral Health Day.
Okay, and Amelia, what have you got for us?
Yeah, so I spoke to Sarah Salmond. She's a partner at the law firm Minter Ellison Rudd Watts, and she's an expert on sanctions. So I spoke to her about the Russia Sanctions Act that was recently passed.
And Tuva'a will also be speaking to Andrew Little about mental health and the health workers' strike that didn't go ahead. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces. So tuku patuhi mai, text us in the studio on 5395 Waiamai Rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oa I wariwari I ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō he pakihiri roki mā runga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. And you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website or on social media. You can follow us on Instagram at 95BFM News. So let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Our regular interview with Labour's Andrew Little is back, and Tuva'a speaks to Little about mental health and the strike action by health workers that was called off. Here is that interview.
Back in the 2019 budget, $1.9 billion was set aside for mental health, with some of that money being put aside for what was considered the largest gap in our mental health services, mild to moderate conditions. Since then, and now 2 years into the pandemic, have we seen this investment improve New Zealanders' mental health yet, or will it take a few more years? And also, how do we measure mental health, and how do we measure if it's getting better?
Yeah, two really good questions. On the first, look, I think we are starting to see a difference now with the benefit of that money, 2 years into it, and it's a four-year implementation program. We've got about 850 additional people on the front line. So most of them are people in GP clinics, and they're people, if they turn up to the doctor with whatever else that's going on, the doctor thinks that there are some mental health issues, they can refer the patient straight away to one of these people called a health improvement practitioner for some kind of free clinical guidance on what it is that's causing their anxiety or depression or whatever. Now, they're doing sort of between 17,000 and 20,000 sessions a month across New Zealand. And so I think that is starting to make a difference. I mean, the stories I've heard, and these are only anecdotal, but of people who were really worried, got the help they needed, got things sorted out in their lives that were causing them anxiety or depression, and life moved on. So these are people who then didn't need kind of more expensive forms of treatment later on. In terms of the bigger question, how do you measure it? I mean, I know the Mental Health Foundation, who do brilliant work, have a very good approach to this, because they say it's not just about whether you have a diagnosed mental health condition. It is that broader sense of well-being. Are things going right? Are there things that, you know, I can take control of, that I can deal with? Are there things outside my control, or maybe things that other people are responsible for that I need to see put right? So they have a much broader view about that kind of sense of personal well-being that is a driver of of your mental health. And I think that, you know, and that's the right approach. When we think about mental health, you know, we're not just thinking about mental health services. We're also, as a government, thinking about those things that can undermine good mental health, such as housing and, you know, poverty, particularly child poverty, things like family violence, those sorts of things. It's why we've made all of those things a priority in the work that we do.
So last week, Dr. Shane Reti of the National Party displayed some graphs showing that hospitalizations due to self-inflicted harm had increased over the time period of the pandemic. Where did he get his data from, and is it accurate?
Well, he got it from, there's a sort of an online outfit that does all these official information out requests, and then they got some information. But the way that Shane Reti had depicted it in some graphs was inaccurate, so he had missed some data points. So he showed this sort of upward-looking graph, where actually if he got all the data points over the relevant period, what he would have shown is actually, look, it goes up and down, but actually it was reasonably static. And it's not to say that this isn't, you know, admissions for self-harm aren't a concern. Of course they are. I think the other thing he was trying to say was that this was, that self-harm is automatically an indicator of suicidal intention or suicidal ideation, and it's not. People can self-harm without any intention of wanting to kill themselves. So he was kind of wrong on two counts. But look, the information is showing that the pandemic and the fact that we've had lockdowns and all those sorts of things that's been really disruptive have affected people's mental health, have affected people's sense of well-being. We know that, and that's why we put additional funding into services supporting particularly young people. It's young people who I think have been the hardest hit because their social networks were so badly disrupted at school and sport and the community. And so we've had to provide some additional support to help young people and their families get through it.
Has it been harder to get the support to the people that need it because of the pandemic?
Yeah, because a lot of the places, a lot of the sort of community organisations that are there to provide support, they haven't been able to do face-to-face stuff. A lot of it's had to be online. I mean, that said, you know, there has been an uptick in the use of online kind of support services. So we've also funded some of the online providers of help, to, you know, apps like Mentimeter, and others that we've supported as well. And that, look, that has been useful. That's been good. We've supported a parenting app as well. So for parents who are struggling to deal with kids who are really unsettled, that's helped. But sometimes there's no substitute for just being able to talk things through, actually talk to somebody and get a response and get sort of guidance through whatever it is that you're feeling at the time. And we know that telehealth services have seen quite a, or did during the lockdown, saw quite a big increase for a period of time. So all of those things have had to be put in place in what have been very difficult times.
So nearly 10,000 health workers were about to strike for two 24-hour periods last month and this month as they're unhappy with their pay and working conditions, but was called off when the employment courts ruled in favour of the DHBs. Why do you think these health workers are wanting to strike? Is what they're asking for unwarranted?
No, look, the health workers, they do an absolutely terrific job. Their pay has been held back over many years for a long time. We've certainly been trying to improve that. We got a set of pay guidelines last year that were quite restrictive, and I think this is a group of workers who have been trying to negotiate pay increases that go outside that. And look, it has taken a while. There's been about 15 months of negotiations. It's now gone to a process called facilitation. I have total sympathy for the wish to get improved pay and conditions. Part of the difficulty we're dealing with is we've done some big pay equity agreements in the health sector recently. We're still working to bring those to fruition. This is another group of workers. They also have a pay equity claim, but that has barely started, and we've got a long way to go to get through that. There was a sense, too, that with these negotiations, they were trying to get things that they are also trying to get through their pay equity claim, and for which there is a separate process. So a little bit of sort of bringing the two things together. So that's why I think the DHBs took the view that they thought that the strike was that for the reason given the strike was unjustified. The pay increase is not unjustified, of course it's not. But some of the part of what they were trying to get has to go through a different process. Look, we are continuing to work. As a minister, I'll continue to work with both the DHBs and the unions to try to get a satisfactory agreement. And we hope that I'm hopeful that that is, you know, not too far away.
Do you think when people looking to get into the health sector see these disagreements between DHBs and unions about the pay and working conditions, do you think this affects the way they think about the health sector and whether or not they might be more inclined to choose that career over other careers? Or is it potentially affecting maybe why there might be a few staff shortages here and there in the health sector?
Well, hard to know, to be honest. You know, it is, the health sector has, they do have a lot of vacancies. They're struggling to recruit. There's an international shortage of nurses and doctors and other specialists. I mean, that is just the reality, and we're playing in that market, trying to get people here, and then trying to get, you know, young Kiwis into training into those health roles. I have to say, I mean, in that respect, we're doing a lot better. So there were 1,700 graduates from nursing programs in various New Zealand Polytechs and what have you last year. We have found places for all 1,700 of those graduates in the system. We've got new entrance to some of the specialist areas, particularly mental health, so record numbers of existing health qualified people going into some of those specialties. So look, we're starting to see some improvements in that, but I would hope that people, you know, people who are, you know, good at science, who care for people, see health and health care as a good calling, as a good profession, are thinking seriously about that, because it is a great sector to be in. The great experiences, and you know, it is kind of the front line of humanity. And if people are thinking, young people in particular, thinking about what they want to do, getting into the health sector, getting into health services is not a bad place.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
Get your hands dirty this Sunday at Motat with a live day all about gardening.
Make a seed bomb with Rainbow Rascals. Build your own bird feeder. Explore Motat's beautiful gardens and get stuck in with Paku tools. Traditional Aotearoa agricultural tools reimagined for kids.
All that and more to cultivate your curiosity at Motat's Gardening Live Day. This Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more info, go to motat.nz.
Hey, what's a 7-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in 6?
Cool, man.
Wait. Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
Well, I know tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
a live tribute to Nujabes, followed by Bobby Brazuka and TDK.
And tomorrow,
Thabani Gapara Project live, followed by Junior and Sultry.
Sweet as, one of those actually solves 13 across.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Thank you. strong as love can be. It's brave to be in love. Sometimes I feel weak.
And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Parliament unanimously passed the Russia Sanctions Act last week in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The act was passed with urgency, and Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says it would be able to target those associated with the invasion, including people, services, companies and assets. I spoke to Sarah Salmond, partner at Minter Ellison Rudd Watts, who is currently helping clients navigate these new sanctions. I started by asking her what sanctions are and what is their objective.
So sanctions are prohibitions or restrictions that a government, like the government of New Zealand, will impose on foreign governments, regimes, entities and people with the objective of tackling an issue that's of concern. So the objectives of sanctions are twofold. You want to punish bad behaviour and you want to incentivise the targets of sanctions to change their actions. So in the current case, we have the New Zealand government targeting a lot of entities and people in Russia with the hope that that is going to lead to Russia's ultimate withdrawal from Ukraine.
How much business do Russia and New Zealand engage in? Is it enough for these sanctions to have a meaningful impact?
So New Zealand has a relatively healthy export trade with Russia. We send quite a few primary products, so butter, seafood, apples, meat, etc. We also import goods from Russia, and that's predominantly fuels and fertiliser. But perhaps more important than that, we have other economic ties with Russia. So a lot of New Zealand's financial institutions, super funds, banks have investment portfolios in Russia. We also have a number of service providers who provide high-tech items to the Russian economy. So in fact, New Zealand's economic relationship with Russia is a lot more complicated and deeper than many people might expect.
The Russia Sanctions Act, it's been described as historic legislation that signals a major shift in New Zealand foreign policy. Why is this?
So up until this new piece of legislation was passed, New Zealand could only impose sanctions on foreign entities and governments if there had been a UN Security Council resolution authorising those sanctions. And so this new piece of legislation actually gives the New Zealand government the opportunity to impose sanctions irrespective of whether there's any UN Security Council resolution.
Do you think that this re-establishes the argument for an autonomous sanctions bill in New Zealand? Should we have a permanent mechanism for imposing sanctions?
So that's a really interesting question, and that's going to be an issue for debate for the Parliament in the years ahead, no doubt. I think it was very important to act quickly to address the situation in Russia, and the government needed to pass Russia-specific legislation to do that. There are arguments for establishing a more general autonomous sanctions piece of legislation, but one of the risks, of course, is if we have the ability to oppose autonomous sanctions in a wide range of circumstances, we're going to find people from right across New Zealand requesting the imposition of sanctions in response to a lot of situations of international concern, and that's going to divert a lot of government resources and have implications. So we have to carefully do a cost-benefit analysis of whether having a wider autonomous sanctions regime is in the net benefit of New Zealand Inc.
What kind of action have we seen from Russia in response to these international sanctions so far?
So what we've seen, and I should add that, you know, it is not just New Zealand sanctions that are suddenly going to stop the war in Russia. It's the cumulative effect of Western government sanctions on Russia that will prompt a difference. So what we're seeing is the Russian government are, in response to Western sanctionings, are turning inwards. They are restricting media coverage. They are imposing their own countermeasures. So now what we're seeing is the Russians are passing a lot of presidential decrees at the moment which prevent strategic goods, services and capital investment and foreign exchange, importantly, from leaving the country. So they're very much turning inwards and trying to support their people, probably with the ultimate objective that the people don't turn on the government, because one of the primary things that the sanctions are targeted to do is to put pressure on the Russian economy and therefore on Russians and prompt them essentially to turn on their government in response.
You've been advising clients on how to comply with these new sanctions. What kind of difficulties have you run into so far?
So all sorts of interesting difficulties. I mean, one of the key problems with sanctions is that quite often a company that's in New Zealand is not just subject to New Zealand law. So if you're a New Zealand business and you have New Zealand directors and you sell New Zealand produce and you sell it in New Zealand dollars, well, then in that case, you're only going to be subject to New Zealand law, and we're advising them on what are those provisions and whether they can or can't do business. But the global economy is so much more complicated than that now, and what we find is a lot of New Zealand businesses actually have an American parent or an Australian director, or they sell actually a finished product which largely relies on American IP or American input, and they trade in US dollars. And as soon as you have all those sort of foreign links to your business, there's a very high likelihood that you actually need to comply with other countries' laws. So the thing that we're doing for our clients is working out first what laws apply to you. And then when we know the answer to that question, we look at the relevant laws and go, these are the restrictions that apply to you. These are the risks of continuing to do the business that you do. And if those risks are too high, then we make a plan for how can we help you to exit that business as soon as possible and as soon as required.
Will these sanctions be felt by everyday New Zealanders?
No, probably not. Not in a material way. So they'll be felt by people who have shares in certain companies that might be impacted. They'll be felt by a number of us with our, you know, KiwiSaver portfolio if we have some investments, because some financial institutions are going to make a real loss on Russian investments, and the primary reason for that is you can't exit those investments, you can't sell them to anyone, but their value is tanking because the value of the ruble is tanking. So there will be some minor impacts in that regard. Probably the thing we will notice most is increasing prices for grains, because Russia and Ukraine are two of the world's largest grain producers. Similarly, increasing prices for fuel, and we're seeing that now as Western governments turn off the tap on Russian oil and gas. The global supply of those products is reduced, and therefore, by definition, prices go up. And the other area where we might see an impact for a wider group of New Zealanders is fertiliser. So Russia exports a lot of fertiliser, not generally the type of fertiliser that New Zealand uses, but in general, if you take their supply out of the market, you're probably going to see an increase in price for fertiliser, which will be felt by farmers across the board.
That was Sarah Salmon, partner at law firm Minter Ellison Rudd Watts, discussing the new Russia Sanctions Act.
Cool, and moving on. A recent OECD report has highlighted the need for increased levels of equity funding and better support for teachers and school leaders in disadvantaged schools. I spoke to Linda Stewart, the former president of the NZEI and the current principal of Mayroads School, about the report. I believe on Tuesday, the OECD and OECD report highlighted the need for increased equity funding and support for disadvantaged schools. I was wondering if you could just touch on this a bit.
I think the OECD report is another reminder that New Zealand's got an equitable education system. Many of us have been trying to reverse this over years, but there are some significant changes that need to happen as far as supporting those schools where there are more challenges, more needs through societal issues. It's absolutely clear that it needs to happen. I think over the time that we have had COVID, I think many of the inequities have been really starkly highlighted over that time, and so there are ways forward, and I think we need to be looking at ways that we can actually reverse it, as I said earlier.
Can you tell me a bit about the report's findings showed that experienced teachers are more likely to work in advantaged schools in New Zealand compared to other countries. I guess, is this a reflection of the support within disadvantaged schools that basically isn't there?
No, I think that it's interesting that that's found, and it's obviously quite true. But what we need to do, and I think this is where we need to go, we need to be able to attract and retain experienced teachers in the profession. And that looks like significantly increasing funding. It looks like smaller class sizes. It looks like additional staffing, particularly to support those students who are struggling with learning or behaviour. That would support our teachers, all of our teachers, to be the best teachers that they possibly could be in those situations. Our teachers need the time to be able to devote to their professional learning, and we know that teachers in this country are time poor. So if you're time poor and you're not getting the support that you need to actually address those needs that are in the schools that we're talking about, then actually are you going to want to stay within the profession? You know, we need to be able to keep great people in our profession, and so these issues that have been highlighted really do need to be addressed.
The OECD report has recommended has a lot of recommendations for the government to ensure that schools get the right support that they need. Yep. Is there anything else which you would recommend?
No, I think it would be really good if government looked at the report, took it seriously, and started to think about those things that we have been asking for some significant time. And I talk about, you know, those small class sizes. I talk about the additional staffing that we need, particularly in primary schools, to support those students. We've been crying out for that for some significant time. And I know that there is work happening to address the equity funding into schools, but I think there's a sense of urgency around it now that's highlighted in the report.
Is there anything else which you feel like hasn't been touched on within the OECD report, or anything else within disadvantaged schools which you feel like should get some attention?
So I think that teachers come into working in schools with a real passion. They really want to make a difference for our kids, and they work really closely with families, and in order to sort of encourage them to enjoy education and to be part of what happens for their child in education. And I think that having the time, having the support, having the additional staffing and resourcing is absolutely pivotal to enabling that to happen. One of the things that we find we don't always get the time for is those in-depth conversations with families. And I think that where we do have additional staffing, that can be really, really useful.
Now, do you think with COVID and the situation that New Zealand is faced with right now, with schools shutting down and kind of learning being moved to online, do you think that this situation is quite dire?
I think that there have been a number of mechanisms to try and address things such as the digital divide in our country. So those children, families who don't have Wi-Fi, who don't have digital devices, many of us in our schools are doing that as best we can. There does need to be a more systemic way of doing, of provision of internet across the country and also devices across the country in a more systemic way. And I think that people are looking into that, but there probably is a sense of urgency needed around that. I think that when we look at families, and I'm a principal of a low-decile school, when we look at families, they're struggling to really make ends meet, and that gets highlighted. We hear about that a lot, but it's the face of that. I mean, each child in their family is a new face that is actually in the face of struggle at the moment. And so supporting our families to have those things that they need, you know, the basics that they need in their homes, I do believe that the government's trying to do that, but I actually do think that there's some systemic stuff that we can do within our schools that would help teachers, principals to absolutely be able to meet the needs of many of these children.
That was Linda Stewart talking about the recent OECD report detailing the need for increased levels of equity funding and better support for teachers and school leaders in disadvantaged schools.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Thursdays, I'm in love. Thursdays, I'm in love. The Tuning Fork's monthly music discovery night is back for 2022. Featuring for March, Louisa Nicklin, Lips, and Rip Ship. Thursdays, I'm in love. Thursdays, I'm in love. With Louisa Nicklin, Lips, and Rip Ship. Thursday, March 17th. Tickets are just $10. Get yours now from WashTix.
This is a radio ad for Hop Kombucha.
New Leaf Kombucha's trademark non-alcoholic beer, made on site at their New Leaf Kombucha tap room in Ponsonby.
Hop Kombucha is gluten-free and guilt-free, with no additives, no colourings, and no preservatives. Brewed using pure kiwi hops, it's everything you love about beer without the beer.
Come and try a free sample at the New Leaf Kombucha tap room, 37 Crummer Road. Working from home? They've got you covered. Order online at newleafkombucha.nz for free Auckland shipping.
New Leaf Kombucha. Hangover sold separately.
Radio ad over.
Thanks a lot.
Play some Chili.
I don't know if we...
Play some Slayer.
Yeah, all right. Hold your horses. Okay, this one's called Raining Blood.
One, two, three.
95BFM's Jukebox Parlour is taking all your requests. And we know you have requests. Jukebox Parlour with Sue. Jukebox Parlour with Song. Saturday, 7 to 9 p.m. Only on 95BFM.
Thank you.
Some of your dozy mates in the media and got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Welcome back to the Thursday Wire. Earlier this week, the government announced the date of the border reopening. The country's border is set to open for tourists and others from Australia without residence visas from midnight 12th of April, and travellers from visa waiver countries such as the US and the UK will come in May 2nd with mandatory vaccination and a negative pre-departure test necessary. I spoke to Dr. David Welch, a senior lecturer from the Centre for Computational Evolution and School of Computer Science at the University of Auckland, on the matter. Here he is now. So what were your initial thoughts on this border reopening being earlier than expected?
I think it's about right. I mean, it was pretty clear to me and other people who have been looking at this that, you know, the borders weren't going to stay open for a very long time, and that there was always going to be an announcement coming, that had them opening earlier. We've got a lot of cases in the country now, as we all know. And we've got, higher cases than a lot of other countries worldwide. So as long as the people coming here are, fully vaccinated or at least have two shots are taking those tests before they get on the plane, when they get off the plane, also a few days later, that will give us a decent level of protection.
Where New Zealand is with case numbers and such, an early border reopening, is it the right choice, just with all the with all the amount of case numbers we have?
I think that added risk of opening the borders isn't really adding that much to what's happening anyway. You know, with the borders already partially reopened, of course, you know, so anyone who is a New Zealand citizen or resident or is on some sort of residence visa can already come in. And so, you know, any variants that are circulating around the world will be making their way to New Zealand via that route anyway. So, you know, having tourists coming in, so probably, you know, will be increasing the number of arrivals into the country perhaps tenfold pretty quickly. You know, that might bring things here a bit quicker than it would otherwise, but, you know, I think it's perfectly reasonable in terms of the added risk, the existing risk we've already got here. And, you know, there's a lot of downsides to having a locking out a large part of, you know, the rest of the world from coming here. We've got a big tourism sector and stuff, and, you know, these moves need to really be considered carefully.
Do you think it could be a while before we see tourism take off in New Zealand? Like, do you think there'll be still be quite a delay, especially with the amount of cases we have?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people around the world are pretty... I'd say that, you know, everywhere things don't just go back to normal, right? And we've seen it here, right? We're not in any sort of lockdown at the moment. You know, there is a red light level, but you know, people are allowed to go to cafes, restaurants, bars, all that sort of thing. But by choice, they're not doing that because they see the risk. They see the risk of going into those places. And I think we'll see a similar sort of thing with tourism. I haven't seen numbers recently, but, you know, worldwide tourism, I believe, is still less than 50% of what it was at the start of the pandemic. And these things will take a long time to rebuild. And basically new systems to be put in place, you know, just so people feel safe and confident to travel again, right? So, you know, clearly no one wants to bring in a new variant into a country or anything, but neither do people want to be, you know, traveling in a foreign country and get very sick, right? So people want, you know, confidence that their travel is safe, and we really need to, you know, continue to suppress this virus as much as possible so that people can feel safe, you know, as they go about their daily business.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about genomic surveillance system. Mm-hmm. Now, just for a bit of background for anyone who may not be too familiar with it, could you sort of explain how that works and how that's an integral part into understanding and controlling the threat posed by COVID? I guess that's how you put it in this statement here.
Yeah. So up until the reasonably large Delta outbreak we had last year, basically every positive case that was found, so, you know, people go and get swabbed. The swab would go to a lab who would do a PCR test, which is actually a genetic test itself. And then swabs that were found to be positive were sent on to ESR, which is a main provider to government of genetic services. And they would sequence, they would get get the virus and find the 30,000 genomic letters that make up its genomic sequence. And that would tell us, you know, what variant it was any new mutations that had picked up that would tell us, you know, what was out there in the community, how different cases were related to each other and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of valuable information and a genetic sequence for any case. And as case numbers got very high, certainly in the Delta outbreak, we weren't able to sequence every single case, but we were sequencing maybe 20 to 30% of all cases. And then Omicron came along, and we're overwhelmed by the number of cases, basically. And we've also moved away from PCR testing. And so now we're only sequencing, I think it's less than 1% of all cases.
Now, I guess with the border reopening, do you think there would need to be a bit more improvements to these systems?
Yeah, I mean, so we really need to, you know, the current system, I think we're sequencing around about 400 or 500 cases per week, right? And so, you know, that's a small percentage of even the hospitalized cases, right? So to there needs to be an improvement in, you know, getting positive swabs to the sequencing lab so they can actually do the sequencing. There needs to be support for that. There needs to be more resourcing put into that. And there needs to be a system so that there's an expectation of anyone who, you know, anyone who is a recent arrival in the country, so that they can take that that swab if they find out that they're a positive case, and get that to a sequencing lab. So we need to put some new sort of system in place that would allow that to happen easily.
That was Dr. David Welch speaking on the government's announcement of the border reopenings. Moving on now, the New Zealand Dental Association is calling on the government to deliver on its dental promises prior to World Oral Health Day. I spoke to Dr. Katie Ayers from the NZDA Access to Care spokesperson on the matter. The New Zealand Dental Association has obviously called on the government to improve New Zealand's dental care. So could you just give a bit of background on this?
Well, we're aware that a large proportion of the New Zealand population isn't able to attend the dentist regularly because there's basically no funding available for adults to go to the dentist. And so for over 25 years, the only funding really available for low-income adults has been the $300 emergency dental grant. And prior to the election, the Labor Party promised to increase this $300 grant to $1,000 for beneficiaries. And so we're really hoping that this will be brought into place before the next election.
Now, it also mentions here a bit about the government progressing a much-needed expansion for community water fluoridation. Sorry, I mispronounced that completely.
Fluoridation, yep.
And how this will benefit millions of current and future generations.
So the background, I'm not actually the water fluoridation spokesperson, but the background to that is that only some communities in New Zealand are fluoridated, and it was up to local councils to decide whether or not to place optimal amounts of fluoride in the community water supplies. And last year there was a unanimous decision in Parliament to change that decision making from local councils to put it with the Director General of Health, so that the Director General of Health can mandate water fluoridation in communities, and, you know, ideally he or she, whoever it is at the time, would be ensuring that as many communities as possible receive optimal amounts of water fluoridation. You know, so that would significantly improve the oral health of all New Zealanders with teeth. not just children. Yeah.
I did just want to get your thoughts on World Oral Health Day and how New Zealanders can improve their oral health. Is there any recommendations that you have?
Sure, good idea. So World Oral Health Day is all about promoting oral health, and we're using that as an opportunity to remind New Zealanders about the government's promise prior to the election. But there's a lot that individuals can do to improve their oral health, such as eating a healthy diet, trying to minimise the number of snacks they have, brushing twice daily with a fluoride toothpaste, and seeing their dental professional regularly.
Yeah. Now, do you also think there maybe needs to be a bit more marketing surrounding oral health?
Possibly. I think most people know that sugar is bad for their teeth, and most people know that they should brush their teeth twice a day. I think one of the things that I'm finding a lot of people don't realise is that not all toothpaste in the supermarket does contain fluoride. So some of the brands that are a little bit newer on the shelves don't always contain fluoride. So it's really important when you're choosing your toothpaste to make sure that it does contain a fluoride.
That was Dr. Katie Ayers from the New Zealand Dental Association speaking about calls for the government to deliver on its dental promises prior to World Oral Health Day, which is this Sunday, March 20th. So, yeah, brush your teeth.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa, mō tēnei wiki, ni te mihi, ki a koto katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That is a wrap on the Thursday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke to us, Labour Party's Andrew Little, Sarah Salmond, partner at Minister Alison Rudd-Watts, Linda Stewart, former president of the NZEI and the current principal of May Rhodes School, Dr. David Welsh, senior lecturer, Centre for the Computational Involution and School of Computer Science from the University of Auckland, and then also Dr. Katie Ayers from the New Zealand Dental Association. And thank you to our producers, Joe and Amelia, for their pieces today. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.